"Stevie?" the doctor said. "I don't know," I answered, puzzling with the thing. "It's just that, well, that wasn't the look on his face. El Niño, I mean." I was scared at the time, sure, but looking back on it, I don't think he was threatening me or warning me. It was almost like he wanted something.
"The Aborigine?" the doctor said as we approached Mr. Picton's house. "What could he possibly want from us?"
"Like I say, I don't know."
I brought my voice down to a very low whisper as we formed into a stealthy file to move back inside.
"But something tells me he'll let us know before too long."
Chapter 35. We couldn't have asked for the rest of our plan to play out any closer to its design. When we got back to Mr. Picton's house, Mr. Moore carefully inserted the bullet into an empty gap in the planking we'd taken from the Hatch's wagon, and the following morning we were all woken by the sound of Lucius's wild shouting. He'd gotten up early to have a go at the examination himself, thinking that maybe the rest of us had missed something, which it now looked like we had. Poking around in the small hole with one of the medical probes, Lucius announced that he'd found an object inside, what was definitely made out of some kind of soft metal. And while the rest of us got dressed and had breakfast, he and Marcus went about freeing the thing from the wood. It was an anxious time for the two brothers, and for Mr. Picton, too, and the rest of us tried to make it appear that we were also on edge. But to this day, I don't know how convincing we were. Cheers went up from all sides when the last chips of wood gave way to the detective sergeant's patient knife work and revealed a large, almost intact, and very recognizable bullet. Marcus took the slug inside to the card table and set it down on the green felt surface for the rest of us to look at. I'd seen more than a few such missiles in my time, but I hadn't ever taken the time to really study one as closely as I now did through one of the magnifying lenses. I was trying to get a glimpse of the identifying marks, what Marcus and Lucius had told us about the day before. And they were there, all right, plain enough for anybody to see, or at least the grooves and lands were. As for any defects produced by the peacemaker's barrel, we'd have to judge that from a comparison bullet, which it was now time to obtain by heading into the backyard and putting the cotton bales to the test. With the moves of an expert, Lucius fired the three bullets what he'd found in the pistol and had slightly refurbished into the cotton from across the yard. Only one of the cartridges showed the effects of time by failing to go off. The others ignited admirably, after which it was up to the rest of us to scour the cotton for the slugs, which we located inside of 20 minutes. Marcus and Lucius assured us that they were both in very good shape, so it was now time for the comparison work. But that, they warned, could take many hours. We all went back inside the house, where Marcus had set up the double-barreled microscope on the card table. Going on the assumption that we would eventually get a match on the bullets, we began to plan what other moves we'd need to make over the coming days in order to get a grand jury indictment. Ordinarily, said indictment would have been a sure bet, grand juries generally being the stooges of district attorneys. But as we all knew only too well, we had some special circumstances working against us in this case, and they demanded that we do more than just the usual homework. For Mr. Picton, that meant more long days in his office, continuing to go back over all the information on the case and putting together as many precedents as he could, along with determining what witnesses, expert, eye, and otherwise, should be called to testify. For Marcus and Mr. Moore, meanwhile, it meant going back down to New York to perform a whole batch of crucial jobs. First, they'd have to officially notify Libby Hatch that she was going to be the subject of a grand jury investigation, just in case she wanted to appear at the proceedings and testify as was her right. Mr. Picton figured to make Marcus a special officer of the court, temporarily, so he could handle the notification. Second, the pair had to try to find the Reverend Clayton Parker, a potentially crucial witness whose last known address in New York Mr. Moore would try to discover by heading over to the Presbyterian Church that afternoon. Finally, if Libby Hatch decided not to have anything to do with the grand jury, as we figured would likely be the case, Marcus and Mr. Moore would have to stay in the city and try to watch her movements without getting their skulls broken by the Hudson Dusters. For their part, Lucius and Cyrus were teamed up for the job of going back to the old Hatch place on Monday and turning the house upside down in a search for any additional clues. Miss Howard and I drew the assignment of trying to learn everything we could about the facts of Libby Hatch's mysterious past, a journey what would begin with another visit to Mrs. Louisa Wright, move on to the little town of Stillwater, where we knew Libby had lived for a time, and then take us God only knew where. As for the doctor, he would, of course, continue to work with Clara Hatch. We couldn't hope for an indictment, Mr. Picton repeated, unless the girl could be made to answer at least simple yes or no questions before the grand jury. The doctor and Cyrus left for the Westons' farm that afternoon just after lunch, while Mr. Moore walked down to the Presbyterian church and Mr. Picton returned to his office. They'd all returned, though, before there was any sign of progress from the card table in the parlor. Hour after dreary hour ticked by with no indication of success. But then, at about 6:30, Lucius finally shot out of his chair and started to scream like a madman, a move what the rest of us decided to take as a hopeful sign. Collecting around the card table, we soon learned that our hopes were well grounded. Not only did the spacing of the bullet's grooves and lands, there were seven of each, spiraling to the left, match the barrel of the Colt perfectly, but at the same spot on each of the slugs there was another mark, so small that it had taken hours to identify. It turned out to have been left there, said Marcus, by a tiny nick in the steel of the pistol's barrel just inside the muzzle. This mark would make the ballistic testimony, what the detective sergeants or anybody else gave, carry that not conclusive but still million to one weight we'd been looking for. Even if you accepted the idea that another Colt 45 caliber single-action army model might have the exact same pattern of grooves and lands as ours did, the notion that it would also have exactly the same defect in the barrel was pretty hard to swallow. So it looked like a very big corner had been turned, and the jaws of our complicated trap were starting to close tighter. Mr. Picton was so confident, in fact, that he announced that he intended to schedule the grand jury hearing for the following Friday, only 5 days away. As we discovered the next morning, however, our host's boss, District Attorney Pearson, didn't share his assistant's confidence. When Mr. Picton told him about his plan, Mr. Pearson declared that he now intended to move his vacation, which he'd been planning to take in 2 weeks anyway, up a week, and that he wouldn't be back until the whole unnatural business of the Hatch case was over. Mr. Picton, for his part, didn't seem at all concerned about this. He merrily said goodbye to Mr. Moore and Marcus, who were set to leave for New York at noon, and then withdrew into his office, at which point the rest of us split off to pursue our separate tasks. For Miss Howard and myself, the first order of business was a visit to Mrs. Louisa Wright's house over on Beach Street. It was an odd place, located so near the Schaefer greenhouses that it existed in a sort of continuous daylight, being as there wasn't an hour of the night when some part of the giant floral plant wasn't artificially lit up. Because of this, Mrs. Wright, a pleasant-looking but tough-talking lady in her 50s, whose husband had died during the Civil War when she was still young, had her windows covered with particularly heavy curtains and drapes, what made the house as quiet as the grave. A clock on her parlor mantel was the main source of noise, its steady ticking seeming to cry out that life was slipping by. The many pictures of Louisa Wright's young husband, what decorated the house, completed the funeral home feel of the joint. Mrs. Wright served us tea and sandwiches in the parlor, very content, it seemed to me, to get even further involved in our pursuit of Libby Hatch. And when she heard that she was going to be called as a witness before a grand jury investigating the matter, her contentment seemed to grow into positive satisfaction. As will, with any luck, become clear soon enough what the old girl had to say about Libby Hatch, Reverend Parker, the Hatch kids, and the death of old Daniel was very revealing and reinforced all the things she'd originally told Miss Howard about the case. Because of this, when Miss Howard and I left the house at about 3 to head over to the livery stable and hire a rig for our trip to Stillwater, we were in very optimistic spirits. We engaged the same buckboard, pulled by the same little Morgan stallion, what had brought us back from the old hatch place on Friday, and the first part of our ride east and south, while not exactly luxurious, was made quick and easy by the steady-spirited horse. Unfortunately, the rig itself proved a lot less reliable. Just after we turned onto the road what ran alongside the Hudson, we threw a rear wheel with a jarring, nasty crash, and while the collapse didn't damage either the wheel or the rig, it did mean that we were stuck on the side of the road for a couple of hours until a passing farmer who was carrying some heavy rope offered to give us a hand, raising the buckboard and getting the wheel back on. This process took another couple of hours, and then we had to slowly follow our Good Samaritan back to his farm, where he had the tools to make sure that the wheel stayed in place. Miss Howard gave the amiable, if not very talkative, man $5 for his help, and then we decided that, being as we were slightly closer to Stillwater than we were to Ballston Spa, though we were a good distance from both places, we'd keep heading south and try to at least begin our second assignment of the day. By the time we pulled into Stillwater, the sun was setting on the small town, which didn't consist of a whole lot more than a couple of industrial works on the river and several blocks of houses running inland from the waterfront. The town was considerably more depressing than most of the places we'd seen in the area. It was tough to say just what those factories produced. But there was a general feel of dirtiness and degradation all over the village, of the variety what was usually associated with bigger cities. Even the Hudson, usually clear and inviting this far north, seemed to bear a film of filth in this stretch of its run. The fact that nobody was out on the streets didn't do much to improve the cold, forbidding air of the town, and as the sun began to set much faster very soon after our arrival, both Miss Howard and I began to wonder out loud if we'd made the right decision about which way to turn after getting our wheel fixed. Of course, the fact that we knew Libby Hatch had once lived in this dismal little backwater didn't improve our impression of it any either. I drew the buckboard to a halt in a spot what looked like it might be the center of town, though there was still not a soul to be seen, and then we got down and started to wander about, figuring that eventually we'd bump into someone who could tell us something about the place. Finally, after failing to spot any activity for some 10 minutes, we heard a door open across the street from one of the riverfront factories and saw a man come out of one of the small, shack-like houses what lined the block. Miss Howard called, "Excuse me?" to this character, at which all of his heavy 6-foot frame seemed to jump about a foot into the air. We walked quickly over to where he was standing, and as we got nearer, he looked around anxiously and straightened himself up a bit, like maybe he thought we were either the law or religious types. "Excuse me," Miss Howard said again as we reached the man, "but we're looking for some information about someone who used to live here. Is there anyone we could talk to? I know it's late, but—"
"They'll be down to the tavern," the man answered quickly, taking a couple of steps back from us. "Anyone who ain't home, that is, they'll all be down there."
He nodded at the general area near the riverfront, some 3 or 4 blocks behind us. "Oh." Miss Howard turned to try to locate the tavern the man was talking about, then nodded.
"I see."
She turned back round again. "I don't suppose you could help us by any chance. It was a long time ago, so—"
"I've been here my whole life, ma'am," the man said. "If it was someone who lived in this town, I'll know better than those Dagos and Micks who've come up to work the mills."
Miss Howard paused, studying the man and then smiling just a bit.
"I see. Well, then, we're looking for information about a woman. When she lived here, her name was Libby Fraser, although since then—"
"Libby Fraser?"
The man's face did an odd little dance. In quick, panicky ripples, it went from shock to fear and finally to hatred.
"What the hell do you want to know about her for?"
"Well, you see, we're involved in an investigation."
"Ain't nobody that's going to want to talk to you about Libby Fraser. Not in this town. Ain't nobody that's got nothing to say."
The man's eyes stared out from his dirty face like he was getting more scared and angry by the second.
"Understand? Nobody. She went away from here a long time ago. You want to ask questions about Libby Fraser, you find out where she went after she left and go there."
He spat into the dusty street.
"That'd be the smart thing to do."
Tucking his shirt into his pants more tightly, as if to make it clear that he was serious, the man turned and walked straight back into the house he'd just come out of.
Both Miss Howard and I watched him go with what you might call blank faces.
Well, Miss Howard finally said, you've got to hand it to the woman. She inspires strong reactions wherever she goes.
Looking back down the street, I saw a sign hanging outside one of the buildings on the riverside, past the factory works. I couldn't read just what it said in the near darkness, but it was pretty obvious what the general message was.
You figure we ought to try that tavern? I asked, pointing.
I suppose we have to, Miss Howard answered. We've come this far.
We didn't bother to get back into the buckboard, but walked the 3 blocks or so to the building with the sign, which did in fact reveal that an establishment what could get away with calling itself a tavern in that town, but that in New York wouldn't have amounted to more than a cheap dive, was located inside. I wasn't at all sure how smart it was for a woman and a kid to head into a place like that alone. And I think Miss Howard could read the worry in my face. She pulled out her pearl-handled revolver and let me get a glimpse of it.
Ready?
Was all she said, and she slipped the gun back amongst the folds of her dress. I nodded to her, though I was still plenty nervous.
Okay, I said, and then I pulled open the screen door of the old clapboarded building.
The room inside reeked of all the usual stenches, beer, booze, smoke, urine. But being as it also sat on top of a nice dead part of the Hudson, rotten river water got into the mixture too. There was a long bar and a pocket billiard table, and the joint was lit, or something like it, by a half dozen kerosene lamps. About 20 men were scattered around, only a few of them talking or doing anything at all, other than staring at the walls and out the windows with the dead eyes of hard-working characters engaging in the only recreation they'd ever known or were ever likely to know, sitting and nursing a stiff drink. As it'll happen in such places and such towns, they all turned toward the door at the same time when we entered. And it was a bit of a surprise for us to see, standing at the corner of the bar, the same man we'd been talking to not 3 minutes earlier. Whatever Libby Fraser had done and been in that town, it was powerful enough to make a big, tired man run a long, roundabout route at what must have been a flat-out pace, so as to be able to warn his pals that there were strangers in town asking questions about her. Miss Howard nodded in the man's direction.
Hello, she said quietly.
But the man just turned back to the bar like he'd never seen us before. Not sure of her next move, Miss Howard looked to me. I waited for the low mumbling in the room to start up again before I said, "The bartender," very quietly. We found an empty space at the far end of the bar, then we waited for the thin, sour-faced man behind it to come our way. He didn't say anything, just looked at Miss Howard coldly.
"Good evening," she said, trying the common pleasantries again.
But they didn't work any better this time around. The man just kept staring at her.
"We're trying to find out some information."
"Don't sell it," the bartender answered. "Got drinks, that's all."
"Ah," Miss Howard considered that for a second, then said, "Well, in that case, I'll have a whiskey and a root beer for my friend."
"Got lemonade,"
the man answered, turning the cold stare to me for a second.
"Okay, so lemonade," I said, not wanting the mug to know he was making me nervous. It took the bartender only a few seconds to fetch the drinks, and as Miss Howard laid down some money, she said, "We don't expect the information to be free." But that just seemed to frost the bartender even more. His eyes got thin, and he leaned over the bar to her.
"Now you listen to me, missy."
All of a sudden, every man in the place was staring at us again.
"You already been told that there ain't nobody in this town that's going to talk to you about Libby Fraser. She ain't the smartest person in the world for anybody to talk about, including strangers."
Miss Howard glanced around the dark, dirty room quickly, then asked,
"I don't understand. What is it that you're also afraid of?"
A flutter of dread went through me. We weren't in the kind of place where you wanted to go accusing men of being cowards. But oddly, the bartender didn't leap straight down Miss Howard's throat, nor did anybody else who'd heard the question. They just kept staring steadily, and finally the bartender, in a hushed voice, answered,
"Fear's nothing but common sense sometimes. So's keeping your mouth shut. And after what happened to the Muhlenbergs..."
"The Muhlenbergs?"
Miss Howard repeated, but the bartender caught himself, realizing he'd said too much.
"Just finish up your drinks and get out of here,"
he said, walking down to the other end of the bar.
"Can't you at least tell us where these people live?"
Miss Howard asked, pushing our luck. I don't think you understand. We're conducting an investigation that may result in the woman's being brought up on serious criminal charges.
Everybody in the room just stayed silent. Then one mug in a corner, whose face we couldn't see, said,
"They live in the old yellow house at the south end of town."
"You shut the hell up, Joe," the bartender growled.
"What for?" the man in the corner said. "If they're gonna go after the bitch..."
"Yeah," said the man we'd spoken to on the street. "And what if they don't get her, and she finds out you were part of their trying?"
"Oh."
It wasn't much more than a scared whisper, but it was the last we heard from the fellow in the shadows.
"I ain't gonna tell you again," the bartender said. "Finish your drinks and leave."
The smart move seemed to be to follow the order, being as the atmosphere in the place was becoming very uncomfortable. Fear was having its usual effect on ignorant people, making them antsy and prone to violence. And I figured that we'd best be getting back outside and maybe back out of town altogether. Miss Howard, unfortunately, saw things differently. When I tapped her shoulder and then started toward the door, she did follow, but as we reached the end of the bar, she paused one more time to look at the collection of faces in the room.
"Is every man in this town afraid of her?" she asked.
Knowing that she was now definitely going beyond what those boys would accept quietly, I fairly pushed Miss Howard out the door and then on toward the buckboard, though she wasn't very happy about it. She wasn't a woman to back down in the face of male bullying or threats, and the behavior of the men in the bar had only made her more determined to stick around Stillwater and find something out. Because of that, we didn't end up moving north and out of town again when we got back on our rig, but kept going south until we rolled up to an old, run-down house. The place might have been yellow at some point in time, but now it was just a mass of dead climbing plants and peeling paint. The faint light of a lantern could be seen through one window, and once or twice the silhouette of a person passed in front of it. "We going in?" I asked, hoping that maybe there was still some way Miss Howard would change her mind.
"Of course we're going in," she answered quietly. "I want to know what the hell happened here."
Nodding in what you might call resignation, I got down off the buckboard, then followed Miss Howard past the broken-down little fence what ran around the overgrown front yard. We got to the front door, and Miss Howard was about to knock when I made out something in the darkness away to the side of the house.
"Miss," I said, nudging her with my elbow and then pointing, "maybe you want to look over there."
Turning, Miss Howard followed my finger to take in the sight of some black ruins in the lot next door. They were obviously the remains of another house, being as two crumbling chimneys stood at either end. And even by the faint light of the moon, we could see a couple of cast-iron stoves and some bathroom fixtures, a tub and a sink, lying in the rubble. There were young trees and shrubs growing in the midst of it all, indicating that the fire what had destroyed the place hadn't occurred any time recently. All in all, the scene called to mind the old Hatch place in Ballston Spa very quickly.
"So,"
Miss Howard whispered, taking a couple of steps away from the door and studying the grim wreckage. It seemed to me like we were both thinking the same thing. Maybe those boys in the tavern had been right to be so fearful.
"Wouldn't want to have been in that house," I said quietly. "Fire like that'd be pretty tough to survive."
"Impossible, I'd think," Miss Howard answered, nodding.
But as it turned out, she was wrong. Something had survived that fire. Not just something, but someone. And we were about to meet her.
Chapter 36.
All we ever saw of that dark little house on the south edge of Stillwater was the front hall and the sitting room. But the memory of those spaces has burned so deep in my brain that I could probably recreate them right down to the thousand tiny cracks that were spread out through the walls like so many dying blood vessels. For the purposes of this story, though, it'll be enough to say that we were led into the place, after knocking, by an old Negro woman who looked us over with an expression what said that they didn't get many callers in that house, and that such a state of affairs suited them just fine.
"Hello," Miss Howard said to the woman as we stepped inside the door. "I know it's late, but I was wondering if either Mr. or Mrs. Muhlenberg might be home?"
The old black lady gave my companion a hard, slightly shocked look. "Who are you?" she asked, but before Miss Howard could answer the question, she took care of it herself. "Must be strangers hereabouts. There ain't no Mr. Muhlenberg. Hasn't been these 10 years or more."
Miss Howard took in that information with a slightly embarrassed look, then said, "My name is Sarah Howard, and this is," pointing to me, she tried to find an explanation that would wash in the situation, "my driver. I'm working for the Saratoga County District Attorney's Office, investigating a case that involves a woman who once lived in this town. Her name then was Libby Fraser. We were told that the Muhlenbergs had some contact with her."
The old woman's eyes went wide, and she held up an arm, trying to herd us back outside.
"No," she said quickly, shaking her head. "Uh-uh. Are you crazy? Coming around here asking questions about... You just get out."
But before she could shoo us back into the night, a voice drifted out from the sitting room.
"Who is it, Emmeline?"
a woman asked, her voice cracking roughly.
"I thought I heard someone say, Emmeline, who is it?"
"Nothing but some lady asking questions, ma'am," the old woman answered.
"I'm sending her away, though, don't worry."
"What kind of questions?"
the voice answered, and as it did, I took note of what the doctor would have called a paradoxical quality in the thing. The sound itself indicated someone of about the black woman's age, but the tone and pacing of the words were very sharp and seemed to come from someone much younger. The woman at the door filled up with dread as she sighed and called out,
"About Libby Fraser, ma'am."
There was a long silence, and then the voice from the living room spoke much more quietly.
"Yes, that's what I thought I heard. Did she say she's from the district attorney's office?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Then show her in, Emmeline. Show her in."
Reluctantly, the black woman stepped aside to let me and Miss Howard wander down the cave-like hall and into the sitting room. You couldn't have put a color to the cracked walls in that chamber or to the patches of ancient paper which still clung to a few small spots on them. The furniture, what was clustered around the heavy table that held the lamp, was also in a state of decrepitude. The dim yellow light of the lamp's small, smoky flame spread toward but not into the corners of the room, and it was in one of those corners that our hostess sat on a ratty old divan, a handmade comforter covering her legs and most of her body. She was holding an old fan in front of her face, slowly moving it to cool herself. At least, that was what I thought she was doing. And so far as it was possible to tell, there wasn't another soul in the house.
"Mrs. Muhlenberg?" Miss Howard asked quietly, looking into the dark corner.
"I didn't know," the scratchy voice answered, "that the district attorney had taken to employing women. Who are you?"
"My name is Sarah Howard."
The head behind the fan nodded.
"And the boy?"
"My driver," Miss Howard said, smiling to me.
"And my bodyguard."
She turned back to Mrs. Muhlenberg.
"It seems I need one in this town."
The shadowy head just kept nodding.
"You're asking about Libby Fraser. She's a dangerous subject."
In a sudden rush, Mrs. Muhlenberg took in a big gulp of air with a moan, what would have raised the hackles on a dead man.
"Please," she went on after a few seconds, "sit."
We found two straight-backed chairs that looked a little sturdier than the other items in the room, and tried to settle in.
"Mrs. Muhlenberg," Miss Howard said, "I confess that I'm a little puzzled. I certainly didn't come here looking for trouble or with the intention of offending anyone, but it seems that the mere mention of Libby Fraser's name..."
"You saw what's left of the house next door,"
Mrs. Muhlenberg cut in.
"That used to be my house. My husband's, actually. We lived there with our son. The people of this town don't want to see their own places reduced to charred brick and ashes."
Miss Howard absorbed that for a few seconds.
"You mean she did that? Libby Fraser?"
The head started to nod again.
"Not that I could ever have proved it, any more than I could have proved that she killed my child. She's much too clever."
The mention of another dead kid coming in a town and a house like that had me ready to dive through the sitting room window, get onto the buckboard, and whip our little Morgan until we were all the way back to New York. But Miss Howard never flinched.
"I see," she said in a low but firm tone. I think you ought to know, Mrs. Muhlenberg, that Assistant District Attorney Picton is preparing an indictment against the woman you knew as Libby Fraser for murder, the murder of her own children. That brought another one of those pitiable gasps from behind the fan, and one foot at the end of the divan began to shake noticeably.
Her own?
The foot suddenly grew still.
When? Where?
3 years ago, in Ballston Spa. Still another gasp floated our way.
Not the shooting? The one they said was a Negro?
Yes, Miss Howard answered. You know about it?
We heard rumors,
Mrs. Muhlenberg said,
and a party of men searched the town. Those were Libby's children?
They were, and we believe she killed them, along with several others in New York City. A different sort of sound now came from behind the fan, and after a few seconds I made it out as hoarse sobbing.
But why should I be shocked?
Mrs. Muhlenberg finally said quietly.
If any woman could do such a thing, it would be Libby.
Leaning forward, Miss Howard put all the sympathy she was capable of, which was a very great deal, especially when she was dealing with a member of her own sex, into her next question. Can you tell me what happened here, Mrs. Muhlenberg? It may help us in our effort to prosecute her. There was another pause, and then the soft sobbing stopped, but the foot started twitching again.
Will she be executed?
Miss Howard nodded. It's very possible. Mrs. Muhlenberg's voice now filled with a kind of relief, maybe even excitement.
If she can die, if you can bring that about, then yes, Miss Howard, I'll tell you what happened.
Very quietly and carefully, Miss Howard produced a pad and a pencil, ready to take notes. As Mrs. Muhlenberg launched into her tale, the old black woman left the room shaking her head, as if listening to the story was more than she could stand.
It was a long time ago, Mrs. Muhlenberg began, or maybe it wasn't, to most people's way of thinking. The late summer, 1886. That's when she came to us. My husband's family owned one of the mills here in town. We moved into the house next door right after our marriage. It had been his grandmother's. Oh, it was a beautiful place, with wonderful gardens leading down to the river. The caretaker of the estate lived in this house then. That summer, our first child was born, our only child. I was unable to nurse him, and we advertised for a wet nurse. Libby Fraser was the first applicant, and we both found her charming.
The small gasp of a dead laugh punctuated the statement.
Charming. I always thought, to tell you the truth, that my husband found her a little too charming. But she was desperate for the work, desperate to please, desperate in every way. And I sympathized with that. I sympathized.
After a long pause, Miss Howard gambled a question. And how soon did your son begin to have problems with his health? Mrs. Muhlenberg nodded her head again slowly.
So, you do know about Libby? Yes, he got sick. Colicky, we all thought at first. Nothing more than that. I could calm him and did as much as possible. But I couldn't feed him. And being with Libby always seemed to make him worse. Hour after hour of crying, for days on end. But we didn't want to let the girl go. She really had been so desperate for the work. And she was trying so hard. But before long there was no choice. Michael, my son, just didn't respond to her care. We decided that we had to find someone else.
How did Libby take the news? Miss Howard asked.
If only she had taken the news,
Mrs. Muhlenberg answered, her voice still soft but passionate and heartbroken too.
If only we'd made her take it, and forced her to go. But she was so crushed when we told her, and begged so earnestly for one more chance, that we couldn't help giving it to her. And things did change after that. Things did
change. Michael's health took a turn, for the better, we thought at first. His fits of crying and colic calmed, and it seemed as if he was accepting Libby's care. But it was an evil calm, a sign of illness, not happiness, a slow, wasting illness. He lost color and weight, and Libby's milk passed through him like water. But it wasn't water. It wasn't water. Things were quiet for so long that I thought that maybe Mrs. Muhlenberg had fallen asleep. Finally, Miss Howard glanced at me with a question in her face, but all I could do was shrug in a way what I hoped showed her how much I wanted to get the hell out of that house. Miss Howard was after something, though, and I knew we weren't going anywhere till she got it.
"Mrs. Muhlenberg?" she said quietly.
Yes, the woman answered.
"You were saying..."
"I was saying?"
"You were saying that it wasn't water, Libby's milk."
"No, not water."
We heard another sigh.
"Poison."
I shifted in my chair nervously at the word, but Miss Howard just kept pressing.
"Poison?"
The dark head rocked up and down.
We had the doctor in many times, but he couldn't explain what was happening. Michael was ill, terribly ill, and then Libby's health began to suffer too. That made the doctor think it must have been a fever, some kind of infectious illness that my son had passed on to her. How could we have guessed?
Her foot started to move nervously again.
I was suspicious. Call it a mother's instinct, but I couldn't believe that my son was infecting Libby. No, I was convinced that she was doing something to him. My husband said that I was so careworn I was becoming unbalanced. He said that Libby was exposing herself to danger to help Michael. He made her sound heroic, and the doctor did too. But I grew more convinced every day. I didn't know how she was doing it. I didn't know why. But I began to sit with them when she fed him. And soon I refused to leave him alone with her, ever. But he never got any stronger. The illness grew worse. He was wasting away. And she was getting weaker, too. Finally, I went into her room one day when she was out taking the air. I found 2 packets in her dresser. The first contained a white powder, the second a black one. I didn't know what they might be, but I took them to my husband. He didn't know what the black powder was, but he had no doubts about the other.
Mrs. Muhlenberg seemed scared to go on, but finally she got the word out.
Arsenic.
Miss Howard seemed to guess that I was ready to bolt, and she put a hand to my arm to hold me where I was.
Arsenic? She said. Was she feeding it to your son? If you know about Libby, Mrs. Muhlenberg said with a small hiss, you know that she's too smart to have done anything so bold as give it to him directly. And I was watching her whenever she was with him. Whenever she was with him. But not when she was alone. And that was my mistake. My husband asked Libby why she had the arsenic. She said that she'd been woken one night by a rat in her room, as if we ever had rats. But we couldn't think of any other explanation.
Trying to hold down more sobs, Mrs. Muhlenberg gasped out,
Michael died soon after that. Libby played at being grief-stricken very well. And for days... It was only when we were burying my son that the truth came to me. Libby was standing there weeping, and I realized that her own health was returning. Suddenly I saw everything clearly, so clearly. She had poisoned him. She'd eaten the arsenic herself, and it had passed to him through her milk. Not enough to kill a grown woman, but enough to kill a baby. Satan himself couldn't have been more clever.
That was about it for me.
"Miss Howard?" I whispered. But she just tightened her grip on my arm, her eyes never leaving the dark corner across the room.
"Did you confront her?" she asked.
"Of course," Mrs. Muhlenberg answered. "I couldn't prove anything, I knew that. But I wanted her to know that I knew she'd done it. And I wanted to know why kill my son? What had he done to her?"
The tears started to come again.
What could a baby boy do to a grown woman to make her want to kill him?
I thought for a minute that Miss Howard might try to explain the theory of Libby Hatch's mind, what we'd worked out over the last few weeks. But she didn't. Wisely, I figured, being as even if Mrs. Muhlenberg could have grasped the ideas, she was in no emotional shape to bear them.
"She denied it all, of course,"
Mrs. Muhlenberg went on.
"But that very night..."
One of her hands went up, pointing in the direction of the ruins next door.
"The fire. My husband was killed. I barely survived. And Libby was gone."
Another pause followed, and I prayed that the story was over. It turned out that it was, but Miss Howard wasn't ready to let matters go at that.
"Mrs. Muhlenberg," she said, "would you be prepared to go before a jury and talk about your experiences with Libby? It might help."
That awful, piteous moan floated across the room again.
"No, no. Why? You can tell them. Someone else can tell them. I can't prove anything. You don't need me."
"I could tell them," Miss Howard said, "but it won't carry any weight. If they hear it from you and see your face..."
At that, the moan became another hoarse, terrible laugh. "But that's what's impossible, Miss Howard. They can't see my face. Even I can't see my face."
There was a terribly still pause, and with a sudden chill I realized what the fan was for.
"I have no face. It was lost in the fire along with my husband and my life."
The shadow of her head began to shake.
"I won't parade this mass of scars in a courtroom. I won't give Libby Fraser that last satisfaction. I hope that my story can help you, Miss Howard. But I won't. I can't."
Miss Howard took a deep breath.
"I understand," she said.
"But perhaps you can help in another way. We've been unable to determine just where Libby came from. Did she ever mention her home to you?"
"Not exactly," Mrs. Muhlenberg answered. "She talked many times about towns across the river in Washington County. It was always my impression that she came from there, but I can't be sure."
Miss Howard nodded, and finally letting go of my arm, stood up.
"I see. Well, thank you, Mrs. Muhlenberg."
The old black woman had reappeared at the doorway to show us out. As we started toward the front hall, Mrs. Muhlenberg said,
"Miss Howard?"
We both turned.
"Look at your boy's face. Do you see the terror in his eyes? You may think it's just his imagination, but you're wrong. What was once my face is worse than anything his mind is conjuring up. Do you know what it's like to terrify people that way? I'm sorry I can't do more, and I hope you truly do understand."
Miss Howard just nodded once, and then we moved on back outside, the Negro woman closing the door on us, silently. I moved for the buckboard as fast as I could, and was surprised when Miss Howard didn't do the same. She was staring in the direction of the river, and puzzling with something.
"Didn't we pass a ferry station on our way into town?" she asked quietly, wandering toward the rig.
"Oh, no," I answered quickly, fear making me a bit uppity. "I ain't crossing that river tonight, Miss Howard, no ma'am."
Then I remembered myself as I fumbled for my packet of cigarettes.
"I'm sorry, but there just ain't no way."
Suddenly,
I heard a very disturbing sound, footsteps, plenty of them, shuffling through the dry dust of the road. Both Miss Howard and I stepped away from the rig and stared into the darkness to the north, which soon belched out about 10 of the men from the tavern. They were moving our way, and they did not, to put it mildly, look like they were interested in talking. "Oh, shit," I said, my general reaction to such situations. Then I glanced around, quickly trying to figure out what to do. "We can still get away to the south," I decided, not seeing anything in that direction what would indicate trouble. "If we move fast enough..." The sound of a spinning revolver cylinder caused me to jerk my head back around. Miss Howard had her Colt out and was checking the chambers with a look what said she meant business. "Don't worry, Stevie," she said quietly as she hid the gun behind her back. "I have no intention of letting people like that push us around." I looked at the approaching band of drunken, sullen men, then at Miss Howard again and realized I was on the verge of watching something truly ugly take place. "Miss Howard," I said, "there ain't no reason for this..." But it was too late. The locals had reached us and fanned out in a line across the road. The man we'd spoken to when we first hit town stepped out front. "We figured maybe you didn't get our point," he said, stepping closer to Miss Howard. "What's there to get?" Miss Howard answered. "You're a mob of grown men, afraid of a single woman." "You're not just dealing with us, lady," the man answered. "When it comes to Libby Fraser, you're dealing with this whole town. She's done enough damage here. Nobody wants to have anything to do with her, nor with nobody that's got any interest in her. And if that ain't clear enough..." The whole bunch of them took a few steps closer. I don't know what it was that they intended to do to us, but they didn't get the chance. Miss Howard produced her revolver and leveled it at the lead man. "You just back up, mister," she said, her teeth clenched. "I warn you, I will have absolutely no difficulty putting a bullet in your leg, or something more vital, if you force me to." For the first time, the man smiled. "Oh, you're going to shoot me, are you?" He turned to his friends. "She's going to shoot me, boys," he said, getting the usual variety of stupid laughs from his pals. Then he looked at Miss Howard again. "You ever shot anybody before, missy?" Miss Howard just stared at him hard for a few seconds, then said very quietly, "Yes, I have." As if to punctuate the statement, she pulled the hammer of her Colt back quickly. The sincerity of the words and the cocking of the gun were enough to wipe the smile off the man's face, and I think he was about to turn around and call the whole confrontation off. But then a small hissing sound cut through the stillness, and the man cried out, clutching at his leg. Yanking something out of his hamstring, he looked back up at Miss Howard, then slowly crumpled to his knees. His eyes rolled up into his head, and he keeled over onto one side, his hand out in front of him. In it was a plain 10-inch stick, what was sharpened at one end. Chapter 37. Miss Howard and I gave each other quick looks of what you might call horrified recognition as the rest of the men hustled to their friend. "What the hell have you done to him?" one of the men shouted, a question I'd heard before and under similar circumstances. I could only get out the words, "Believe me, it wasn't us," before the men picked up their friend and began to hustle him away in terror. "You get the hell out of here," one of them called, "and you stay the hell out." With that, they disappeared back in the direction of the tavern. Miss Howard kept hold of her revolver as we both spun to look all around. "Where is he?" Miss Howard asked in a whisper. "In this darkness?" I said, also whispering. "He could be anywhere." We didn't move for another minute, but kept listening and waiting, expecting some move out of our small enemy, if in fact he was our enemy, which I was beginning to doubt. But there was no trace of any activity on the road, or in the shadowy trees and shrubs that lined it, and that was good enough for me. "Come on," I said to Miss Howard, taking her arm. She didn't need much persuasion by that point, and in another half minute we were aboard our rig and heading north again, the little Morgan Stallion moving at a nice trot. As we passed by the tavern, I could see a few pairs of angry eyes following us, and the body of the man who'd been struck by the Aborigine's arrow was laid out on the bar. How long he'd be unconscious, or if in fact he was dead, I didn't know, and I certainly couldn't have said why Señor Linares's servant had once again come to our assistance. The first time, during our bout with the Dusters, might have been laid off to his arrow finding the wrong mark. But this second incident made it clear that the strange little man who'd seemed to threaten me with death on Saturday night was trying to keep us alive. "Maybe he just wants to kill us himself," I said, once we'd gotten half a mile or so out of Stillwater.
"He's had more than enough opportunities to do that," Miss Howard answered, shaking her head. "None of it makes any sense."
She finally shoved her revolver back into its hiding place, then took a deep breath.
"You don't have a cigarette, do you, Stevie?"
I shook my head with a small laugh, feeling relieved that we'd made good our escape. "You'd think people would get tired of asking me that question," I said, going for my pants pocket with one hand as I let the reins slack a bit with the other. Pulling out the packet of smokes, I handed them to her.
"Light me one, too, if you would, miss."
She put a match to two cigarettes, then handed one over. After taking a few deep drags off her own, she put her head between her hands and began to rub her temples.
"You got pretty hot back there," I said.
She managed a chuckle.
"I'm sorry, Stevie.
I hope you know I wouldn't put you in danger deliberately, but that kind of insufferable idiocy.
World's full of men like that, Miss Howard. Can't go telling them all where they get off and not expect a few to get riled."
I know, she said. "But there are certain times. Still, I do hope you know that we were never in any real danger."
"Sure," I answered. Then I took a few seconds to study my companion. "You really would have shot him, wouldn't you?"
"If he'd touched either one of us?" she said.
"Absolutely.
Nothing like a bullet in the leg to make men mind their manners." I chuckled again, although I knew that she was perfectly serious. There probably wasn't another woman in the world who was as comfortable with guns, or for that matter with shooting people, as Miss Howard. She had some very personal reasons for being that way, and it isn't my place to recite those reasons here. She'll take care of that job one day herself, if she's so inclined. All that mattered to me that particular night was that when she said she would have shot a man to protect me, she meant it. And that knowledge allowed my nervous system to grow ever more calm and my mind ever more inquisitive as we traveled along the moonlit river road.
"How can she do it, Miss Howard?"
I eventually asked after smoking the better portion of my stick. Miss Howard answered with a long, deep sigh,
"I don't know, Stevie. It's the nature of people who are racked by feelings of powerlessness, I suppose, to try to exert power over whoever or whatever's weaker than they are. And God help those weaker beings if they don't play along. Drunken, frustrated men beat and kill women, women desperate to prove they can control something beat and kill children, and those children in turn torment animals. Remember, too, babies may look charming to those of us who haven't got any, but there are plenty of mothers who lose patience with all the noise, the sleeplessness, and the plain and simple work of nurturing."
I was shaking my head.
"No, that's not what I meant. The actual killing, that part of it I've begun to understand, I think. But the way she makes other people act, how does she pull that off? I mean, look at what we've heard and seen, too. Some people who worked with her in New York thought she was a saint. Other people in the same joint thought she was a murderer. That poor fool husband of hers treats her like she's his sole salvation, but then she goes around the corner and gets the likes of Gugu Knox more lathered up than any mall or streetwalker what's ever been through the duster's front door. Then we come up here and find out that in Boston Spa, people first thought she was a hussy, then a good woman, and then she got ranked as a hussy again. Now we go to this damned place, Stillwater, and find out that the whole town's scared to death of her. How the hell does one person pull it all off?"
"Well," Miss Howard answered with a slight smile, "I'm afraid that question's a little more complicated." She held her cigarette up and puzzled with a thought.
"Try to think about all the things you've just mentioned, Stevie. What's the one quality that they have in common?"
"Miss Howard," I said, "if I knew that..."
All right, consider this then. None of those personalities, those different ways that people see her, are complete. None of them is a description of an actual person. They're all simplifications, exaggerations, symbols, really. The ministering angel, the fiendish killer, the devoted wife and mother, the wanton harlot and brazen hussy. They all sound like characters out of a story or a play.
Like the, whatever, the myths you talked about, that day outside the museum?
Exactly, and like those myths,
What's amazing isn't that someone can come up with such characters. Anyone crazy or just imaginative enough could do that. It's that so many people, not just the citizens of towns like Stillwater, but whole societies, actually accept and believe in them. And I'm afraid all that gets back to something that may be a little difficult for you to understand. Miss Howard must have read something like injured pride in my face because she put a quick hand to my arm. Oh, I don't mean because you're not educated enough or smart enough, Stevie. You're one of the smartest males I've ever known, but you are male.
Yeah, I said. And what's that got to do with the discussion?
Everything, I'm afraid, Miss Howard answered with a shrug. It isn't really possible for men to understand how much the world doesn't want women to be complete people. The most important thing a woman can be in our society, more important even than honest or decent, is identifiable. Even when Libby's evil, perhaps most of all when she's evil, she's easy to categorize, to stick to a board with a pin like some scientific specimen. Those men in Stillwater are terrified of her because being terrified lets them know who she is. It keeps them safe. Imagine how much harder it would be to say, yes, she's a woman capable of terrible anger and violence, but she's also someone who's tried desperately to be a nurturer, to be a good and constructive human being. If you accept all that, if you allow that inside, she's not just one or the other, but both, what does that say about all the other women in town? How will you ever be able to tell what's actually going on in their hearts and heads? Life in the simple village would suddenly become immensely complicated. And so, to keep that from happening, they separate things. The normal, ordinary woman is defined as nurturing and loving, docile and compliant. Any female who defies that categorization must be so completely evil that she's got to be feared, feared even more than the average criminal. She's got to be invested with the powers of the devil himself. A witch, they probably would have called her in the old days, because she's not just breaking the law, she's defying the order of things. I turned to give Miss Howard an uncertain little smile.
You want to watch it, you're starting to sound like you look up to her a little bit.
Miss Howard started to smile back, but stopped quickly. Sometimes it seems that way, even to me, she admitted. And then I remember that picture of Anna Linares, and realize how desperately unaware of her own true motives, and therefore dangerous, Libby really is. Okay, I answered, trying to get Miss Howard perked back up by continuing our discussion. So what about somebody like Gugu Knox? He knows Libby's married to Micah Hunter and is playing the good wife to him, nurturing him, but he still wants to carry on with her. Miss Howard nodded vigorously. It's the same thing. Knox may be a gang boss, but he's still a man. He still wants to slip women into convenient categories to keep them from causing any problems. He doesn't believe that Libby actually cares about Hunter. He assumes that in the deepest part of her soul, she's a libertine, a whore, and that when she performs for him and with him, he's seeing the real Libby. Yet what have we found out? That she's persuaded Knox to place her home under his gang's protection. His thugs are keeping watch over the very house where she's constructed some sort of hiding place for the babies she's still trying desperately to prove that she can care for. So for all we know, she loathes spending time at the Dusters, but does it to facilitate her attempts to nurture. My hand went to my forehead, as if rubbing it would make my mind work harder. So, then, she's not the whore that Knox thinks she is?
She might be, Miss Howard answered, confusing me again.
But you just said she was doing it to take care of the kids. She's doing that, too.
So which one is the actual her? I almost yelled, starting to feel a little dim and not much liking it.
None of them, Stevie, Miss Howard explained, slowing down a bit for me. The actual her was broken to pieces a long time ago. And that's what the different characters she assumes are, the broken pieces, separate from each other, no longer coherent. We don't yet know the specific childhood context that made Libby into the killer she is, but we do know this much, especially given what we've seen and been through since we got up here. Ever since she was just a girl, she was almost certainly told that there was only one way for her to be a full, complete woman.
To be a mother, I said with a nod, which she wasn't any good at,
or which she may not deep down have even wanted to be, Miss Howard said. We don't know. Again, all we do know is that the message girls get when they're growing up, especially in corners of the world like this one, is that if you want to do something with your life other than raise children, not only will your road be difficult, but you'll never really be a woman. You'll just be a female of some indefinite and not very appealing type. A harlot, maybe. Or perhaps a servant. Or, if you join a profession, a detached functionary. Whatever the case, underneath it all, you'll be a cold, unfeeling aberration. With an angry flick of her finger, Miss Howard showered the road below us with sparks from the burning tip of her cigarette. Unless you want to be a nun, of course. And even they don't always get away with it. A man can be a bachelor and still be a man, because of his mind, his character, his work. But a woman without children? She's a spinster, Stevie, and a spinster is always something less than a woman. Well, I said, my brain working too hard at keeping up with her thoughts to worry about being tactful. What about you, then? Miss Howard's green eyes slid slowly sideways to give me a glance what said I'd better make my meaning a bit clearer. What I'm saying, I added in a hurry, knowing how fast her temper could flare, is that none of that business really goes for you. You're not married. You don't have any kids, but you're... I looked away, suddenly embarrassed. Well, you're as much of a woman as any mother I ever knew, if you see what I mean. That brought her hand gently to my arm again and allowed the green eyes to open wider. That's the most decent thing anyone's said to me in a long time. Thank you, Stevie. But remember, too, you're still young. Oh, I said, grabbing at my own chance to get huffy, so my opinions don't count? Or they'll change just because I'll get older? It was Miss Howard's turn to squirm a bit. Well, she noised, it does happen sometimes. Okay, I pressed. What about the others, then? The doctor and the detective sergeants and Cyrus, even Mr. Moore, they all feel the same way. Miss Howard shot me a doubtful look. Hardly an average selection of American men. I'm sorry, Stevie. Of course I value and respect how you and the others feel. You may never know how much. But to the rest of our world, I'll probably always be that strange Sarah Howard, the spinster detective lady, unless and until I have a family. Not that part of me wouldn't like to someday. If I ever feel like I've really made a difference with my work, I might consider children. It's just that I object to the notion that I won't be whole until I do. It's a cruel standard, especially to the women who can't achieve it. Libby couldn't, and the failure broke her. Yes, for all her cleverness, she's terribly broken. A little like your friend Cat in that way, clever yet lost. Lost and somehow... Suddenly Miss Howard's face, so passionate while giving voice to ideas what I knew were as important to her as any in the world, went completely blank. Her words fell off with a quickness what let me know she'd caught sight of something. And there was only one something it could be. Where? I said, whipping my head from side to side. Where is he? Miss Howard put a steadying hand to my shoulder. Just slow down, Stevie, she whispered. If I'm not mistaken, he's right in front of us. I searched the dark road ahead, and there, to be sure, was the silhouette of a small person, the bagginess of the clothes and the bushiness of the hair giving away his identity. El Niño wasn't moving, either away from or toward us. He seemed to be waiting for our rig to reach him, and as we got closer, I began to make out that damned smile again. What the hell? I mumbled. Is he real, even? The mug gets around quicker than spit. Oh, he's real, all right, Miss Howard answered. The question is, what does he want? Figure we should stop? She shook her head. No. Keep going at a walk. She pulled out her revolver and placed it in her lap. Let's see what happens. Chapter 38. I followed the order. The Aborigine didn't move, just stood there smiling until we were about 20 feet from him, Then, very deliberately, he put his hands into the air. I drew the Morgan to a halt and we waited. Lowering one arm, the Aborigine pointed to the ground.
"I don't hurt you,"
he said, his smile getting wider. Following his finger, we could see that there was a small bow, a couple more of the plain little arrows, and another wave-bladed crease on the road.
"And you don't shoot me,"
he went on, putting his arm back up.
"Yes?"
Miss Howard nodded, but she kept the gun right where it was.
"All right," she said. "What is it you want?"
"I to help you,"
the Aborigine answered.
"Sure, can help you, yes. Sometimes I help you already."
"But you're Signor Linares's man," Miss Howard answered. "Why do you help us?"
The Aborigine moved to pick up his weapons, prompting Miss Howard to pull back the hammer of her Colt. The little man's eyes went very wide, and then he threw up his hands again.
"It's okay. I no hurt you, lady, and you no shoot me. I help you."
"Suppose you just tell me why you help us before you pick those things up," Miss Howard ordered.
El Niño's appealing smile returned, and then his round features began to display what you might call theatrical disgust.
"Oh, is not for me to work for the señor, no more. He beat me, beat his wife, beat everybody with fists like...
Looking around quickly, the Aborigine grabbed a big stone from the side of the road, then held it up to Miss Howard.
"Like rocks," she said.
"Yes, it's true, like rocks,"
El Niño answered.
"Give me one suit of clothes."
He held his arms up, displaying the rolled-up cuffs of his jacket, and then pointed down at his trousers, what were cut off roughly at the ankles.
"Too big. It's not for me. First, one time I work for father, old señor."
"For Señor Linares's father?" Miss Howard asked.
"Yes, lady, a different man, good man. This son, not the same. Beat everybody with fists, think he great man, because his mama love him too much."
I burst out laughing at that, and got myself a sharp elbow from Miss Howard for it. But she too was having trouble containing her amusement at the little fellow.
"And so, what do you want from us?"
she asked, lowering the Colt. El Niño shrugged.
"I to work for you, I think. Yes, I think so. I watch you. See you try to find baby Anna. It's good. The señor, he not want you to find her, but she a baby. I think you find her because you good people. I work for you, I think. Sure."
Miss Howard and I exchanged shocked looks. What were we supposed to say? The idea seemed so strange as to be out of the question, but neither of us particularly wanted to tell him that. Not with that arsenal lying in the road, and knowing that he'd been keeping track of every move we'd made for weeks now. There was also the fact that we'd both identified something likable in the little fellow, likable and decent. So maybe it wasn't so peculiar a notion after all.
"But," Miss Howard said, "what do you mean, work for us? What would you do?"
The Aborigine was about to answer, but first he eyed his possessions on the road.
"I can pick up,"
he said to Miss Howard carefully. She nodded, looking at him like he was a naughty kid.
"Slowly," she said.
He followed the instructions and tucked all the pieces of his arsenal into big pockets, what had been sewn special inside his jacket. Then he started to approach us, swaggering like a man twice his size.
"Many things I do," he declared. "Protect you from enemies. Kill them or make them sleep. Cook, too."
He pointed at the landscape around us.
"Snake, dog, sometimes rat, if you very hungry."
Both Miss Howard and I let moans of disgust out through the smiles that had settled in on our faces.
"See things. Find things out. If you have El Niño to work for you, you have eyes everywhere."
He passed an arm out across the horizon again.
"And what," Miss Howard asked, "would be your salary for all this?"
"My sir,"
the Aborigine noised, puzzled.
"What would we have to pay you?"
"Oh, pay, yes,"
he answered, filling his chest with air proudly.
"El Niño Maniliman. Maniliman work only for pay. The señor pay me with nothing, with shit."
I let out another loud laugh, and Miss Howard didn't even try to stop me. In fact, she joined in. And so did El Niño, who was pleased with our reaction.
"With shit he pay me," he went on. "Bad clothes, food after others have eaten it. And the señora make me to sleep outside, even in wintertime. You can give me good food, bed to sleep in, yes? House has many beds, and you,
He pointed at me, and then he did the little dance around his neck with one hand again, causing my grin to shrink suddenly.
"Whoa, now, don't start that," I said. "I don't want any trouble with you."
"No, no," he answered. "Not trouble. Clothes. Your clothes. 3 nights passed from here. You do not like your clothes, yes?"
Counting the nights on my fingers and trying to get some idea of what he was talking about, I remembered the trip to Saratoga, and then, in a rush, I recalled my encounter with what I'd taken for a kid in the gardens of the casino.
"So that was you," I said. "You saw me in the monkey suit."
"Monkey suit?" El Niño asked, puzzled. "Not for monkeys. Fine clothes for fine man. Fit me." "You do not like them," he said, putting the finger to his neck again.
Then I got it. He'd seen me straining at the white tie and figured out that I hated wearing the thing.
"Stevie," Miss Howard said, "what does he mean?"
"He saw me at the casino, saw that I don't like wearing them clothes. I think he wants them."
I spoke louder to our new friend. "You want those clothes? Is that the deal?"
"Fine clothes for fine man,"